For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we are in Mark 12, which is a pretty dense chapter, actually. And so we're going to try to gulp down pretty much the whole thing tonight. We're talking about the topic of seeking, because that is the one kind of theme that brings together all of the little stories that make up this chapter. And so we want to engage in this question of what does it really mean to be a seeker after God? And what does it mean to be open spiritually? And an important way, I think, too, to consider, what does it mean by contrast, really not to be a seeker, to be kind of a pseudo-seeker and one who's not really open-minded at all? Because by way of contrast, Mark 12 really covers both of those grounds. And Jesus is going to interact with the religious establishment as they kind of draw their final verdict about Jesus in three very quick sequences, interactions. And then the chapter ends with Jesus making comment about a poor widow giving all that she has at the temple. And so what we're looking at here is a range of what does it mean for human beings to be in search of God. And so let's just take the contrast first, then we'll get to the good part here in just a minute. I'm calling the first part of the chapter three insincere questions. God is not afraid of our questions. God's all about that. I was thinking just the other day, I've been studying the book of Isaiah with a friend, and we were noticing in chapter one of this incredible 66 chapter odyssey into the plan of God from the beginning to the end of time. Just, it's an amazing book. But at the beginning of it, Isaiah welcomes people and he says, "Come, let us reason together." In other words, biblical faith is faith that we proceed with our minds, that is not rationalistic in the sense that we have to prove everything, but it's reasonable, and that there is evidence given, and God calls on people to respond to the evidence that he's put forth before us. And in fact, he calls on his people to be prepared, to be ready to give a reasonable defense for the hope that is within us, according to 1 Peter 2:3. But there are also are ways of asking questions that, you know, you really are not even looking for an answer. You're really looking more for commentary. And so, you know, you may hear some news that is startling or very unusual, and you may say to the person who gives you this information, "Well, that's hard to believe," right? But you're just asking, you're just stating an opinion. You're saying, you know, could it be really? Are you sure? Or you could say it in another way, and you say, "Well, that's hard to believe. You got to be kidding me." Okay, well, the language is pretty much the same, but we're really making two very different points, right? The second one is not even a question at all. It's just an editorial comment about your disdain for the news or whatever. And that's where these people are coming from that Jesus is interacting with. It says in Mark 12, verse 12, I didn't put this on the overhead, it says they were seeking to seize Jesus, and yet they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke the parable that he had just given against them. And then it says in verse 13 that they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus in order to trap him in a statement. So there's going to be a series of questions here, but they're not very sincere questions. They're loaded questions. There are three kinds of them. The first is what I'm calling here the landmine question. And this is where the Herodians, these are the people who are living and working for the household of King Herod, the monarch, the guy who oversees Judea, and Pharisees, which are strict Jewish religious separatists. And they don't agree on anything at all. So it's amazing that they, two of them, would come together to ask Jesus a question. And the question they ask him is, "Should I pay my taxes?" And so you know, you get into this question then about, you know, if I say, "Well, yes, you should pay your taxes," then the Pharisees are going to be like, "Oh, you traitor. You know, you're just supporting the opposition, the occupation. But then if you say, well, no, you shouldn't pay your taxes because, after all, the Romans are usurping their authority and so forth. And well, then boom, you're in real trouble on that point. And so that's why it's a landmine question. It's intended to give offense. It's like someone sitting down with you, as people have with me many times, and said, hey, so is God a Republican or a Democrat? To which I always say, that depends on which party's in office. Anyway, that being said, Jesus avoids the landmine by showing the underlying complexity of the question that's really there. They're asking for, in Mad Magazine terminology, snappy answers to stupid questions. Jesus is going to go a little bit deeper and not fall into their trap and just say, look, render unto Caesar what is Caesar, and unto God what is God's. That's a real famous maxim, isn't it? Everyone's heard that one. But basically what he's saying is we have responsibilities to both sides. So in that way, he gets out of this intent on the questioner to give offense. Then there is a second species of question that shows kind of the insincerity of the seeker, which I'm calling here suicide bomb questions, which are really all about ridicule and where they're not really taking seriously what a person believes at all. They're not taking a claim in any way seriously. They're just looking for ways to show that, well, that's, you know, that's really stupid that you believe that. It's ridicule. So, for instance, I was a philosophy major in college, and I took this philosophy of religion class, and the professor gets up there, and she goes, you know, today we're going to talk about why belief in God is just a self-contradiction. It doesn't make any sense. And she goes, here's the dilemma. Could God build a rock so big that even God himself couldn't move it? What do you think? Well, it's a stupid question. But so is this. The Sadducees, this other religious group, they ask Jesus this question. They say, who will I be married to in heaven if I've had more than one wife on earth? So, you know, again, he's basically trying to show that the whole idea of heaven is just kind of this dreamland. It's really stupid. It really falls apart on closer analysis. And he's making fun of Jesus is basically what he's doing, and anyone who would believe in an afterlife, because oddly enough, the Sadducees, who were the priests of Judaism, did not believe in such a thing as the afterlife, nor did they believe in the supernatural. Weird. So anyway, Jesus, in listening to their so-called dilemma, responds by uncovering their hidden assumptions. In other words, they lay this little dilemma out, thinking that's somehow going to trip Jesus up. And Jesus just goes to the point. He says, you know, the scripture itself teaches that there is an afterlife, because God, after all, spoke of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the present tense as though they were still alive, because of course they are. And by the way, he says, your whole concept of heaven is just this, you know, extension of the way life on earth is. And sadly, maybe for some of us, maybe less sadly for others, I don't know, Jesus says in heaven there will be no marriage. And so there's not, that gets out of the dilemma. And then the third little controversy they get into here is what I'm calling control tower questioning, where really the issue here is just, I'm asking this theoretical question. I'm just asking, you know, for asking's sake, because really it's just all about intellectual engagement and asking, you know, deep questions and stuff like that without any desire to put them to practice. The scribes, who are the real theologians and the intellectuals of the first century Jewish world, they come to Jesus, they ask him, you know, what rule's most important? What's the greatest commandment? And so they're looking for a theological sparring match. And Jesus, of course, answers them and says, of course, as it says in Deuteronomy 6:4, to love the Lord your God with all your being. And the other one is like it from Leviticus, I think it's 18, verse 19, love your neighbor as yourself. And so they're taken aback by that. But then Jesus presses the issue further and exposes their hypocrisy, saying, look, okay, that's obvious. You knew that already. But the weird thing about you is that while you are raising this very pertinent question about what is really important from God's standpoint in terms of what we ought to be all about, you don't do any of these things. You don't put the Lord your God first and love him with your whole being. And you most assuredly do not love your neighbor as yourself. And so he really puts them down in that way. So here, of course, in doing this, Jesus just seals their contempt for him. And they're ready, you know, to find any occasion they can then to have him executed and gotten out of the way. Now this framework comes in very stark contrast to the next scene in the story, where in verse 41 it says that Jesus sat down near the collection box in the temple and watched as the crowds dropped in their money. Many rich people put in large sums. Then a poor widow came and dropped in 2 lepti. I used to have a friend that we called Lepton. Jesus called his disciples and said to them, "Hey, I tell you the truth, this poor widow gave more than all others who are making contributions. Because why? They gave a tiny part of their surplus, but she has given everything she has to live on." Now, do you see the incredible contrast between this woman and just the simplicity of her life and the simplicity of how she's pursuing God and the kind of intellectual jousting that the religious establishment was up to? That's what I want to get into, because in showing these contrasts, I think it isolates some very important questions for us about what does it mean for me to be an authentic, real seeker after God. Let's break it down. The pseudo-seeker and the true seeker. The pseudo-seeker, as we've seen, you know, really is about, when questions are raised or whatever, it's really banter. It's closed-minded questioning. It's not, "Hey, I got this question, and it's really dogging me, and I'm trying to work it through, and help me understand this thing." It's not like that. Each of these three series of interrogations with Jesus were not open-minded at all. They were totally closed-minded. And they really represent people that Paul talks about in 2 Timothy 3, verse 7, where he says they're always learning, but never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. And so it is that it is possible to just be all about asking the questions and doing the reading and stuff like that, but never really ever moving any closer to really answering the deep questions that need to be answered. An insincere questioner, a pseudo-seeker, I used to be one, I'm pretty conversant with this, would be the type of person who just has a stream of questions to ask, very much like the way the flow of this chapter is laid out, just boom, boom, boom. And so we ask the question, you know, explain the Trinity to me, and so you begin to get into that. It's not an easy question to get into, but you do. And as soon as you are able to take a breath, boom, we're on to another question. And how could anyone believe that Jesus actually rose from the dead? Well, that's an interesting question too. Let's talk about that. And as you start to get into that answer, then boom, the question changes again to, well, who can even trust that the Bible is history anyway? And you begin to realize with people sometimes along these lines, each of those are very good questions. They're important questions. But it's evident that by just the fact that these are rapid-fire stream of consciousness kind of questions, without any reflection or deliberation on what's being said, that they don't really want an answer. You see what I mean? It's pseudo-seeking. It's that I learned in sociology 101 or whatever to ask these kinds of questions, but the answer to them really doesn't make any difference to me anyway. So I'm just going to show that I know the right questions and I throw them out there. That's pseudo-seeking. And that's real unfortunate. And a pseudo-seeker is going to be the person who has all kinds of questions that they want to ask but are rarely willing to examine their own assumptions. I've had a series of conversations with a friend. I've got several friends who are not Christians that I have interaction with over months and at this point, years, actually. And what I will often find is that the objections are raised. Questions are asked. I'm like, man, it's a great question. And then I start to answer the question, and boom, you know, before I'm done, here's another question. And I'm like, whoa, time out for just a second here. Let's slow down and examine this thing a little bit. And so, you know, one of the questions is, well, if God is all powerful and God is all loving, then how come his creation is such a mess? Well, that's a great question. And this one guy that I interact with a lot, he's just like, well, you know, I can't believe in a God given the terrible, deplorable state of things. I'm like, yeah, that's a great issue to explore. I'm with you on that. However, the way you talk is though somehow atheism answers the question, right? Okay, I'm mad that there's evil in the world, so I'll just erase God from the spectrum. Does that make evil go away? It does not. It does, however, erase any redemptive possibility for dealing with evil or even identifying what evil actually is. And I think it's really important. Some of us here tonight are somewhere in that gray area between being authentic seekers and pseudo seekers. And one of the things that if we are going to really pursue God, one of the things that's important, I think, is the very thing that Jesus was doing as he's interacting with the religious establishment, which is to say, you know, what are the assumptions that you are operating out of? Are you aware of them and the influence that they bear on the questions you ask? What's your alternative? And so the banter of the closed-minded is contrasted with this poor widow Howe, because she was a person of action. How did she pursue God? She went down to the temple. She acted on what she knew. She knew so little compared to what these intellectuals of her day knew. Well, they had the Bible, literally, the scribes, to be sure, they had the Bible memorized. They knew it. They knew all the opinions of all the rabbis about every passage. This woman almost certainly did not have that knowledge, but she was willing to act on what she did know. And that is the mark of a true seeker. Not that you know it all, but that you act on the things that you do know. And very important, James chapter 1, verse 22 says, prove yourself to be doers of the word, not merely hearers who delude themselves. Doers of the word, not merely hearers who delude themselves. And James is making a very important point that is implicit in the observation that Jesus makes of this widow down at the temple. There's a moral component to seeking. There's a moral component. There are ethics in belief. Am I willing to follow you if I'm convinced that you're real? That's a pretty important question. Am I waiting, drumming my fingers or whatever, waiting for you, God, to somehow part the heavens and appear to me before I'm willing to make a move? You know, that's not going to work either. A seeker is someone who says, I don't know it all, but I know some. I believe that there is a God that makes sense to me. And so what do I need to do with that basic belief? Well, it means that maybe I ought to pray. I ought to talk to God. How can I say on the one hand I believe that there's a God, but I never open up any kind of dialogue with him at all? And so being a doer of the word means that with whatever it is I do know, I am prepared to take action just on that. And that's what I think, that's where it starts. The non-Christian friends that I've had over the years who are at a place of honest investigation, I always just encourage them, look, if you're at a place where it just seems plausible to you that God exists, why don't you take this query up with him? And so I challenge you here tonight, you who have maybe got drugged here by your neighbor or whatever, and the thought of actually seeking God is maybe fresh in your thinking. Hey, why not open up a dialogue with God and ask him, God, there's enough evidence out there. I just sense that you exist. And now I want to ask that as I seek more information about you, that you in your own personal way would reveal yourself to me. That is authentic seeking. You can do that. That's honest. There's a real danger in passivity here at this point. To be a doer of the word means that I'm actively interested. I'm willing to respond to the things that I learn. The passive person is the one who is the one who merely hears and who deludes themselves. And I think here, you know, regardless of how far along the line we are in seeking God in our life, and maybe we've been Christians for many years or maybe not, but I want to speak to us who have known Christ for a long time, that maybe we have a danger in not in a continual way seeking God in our lives, that we have become passive, that we have become hearers of the word and not doers of the word. And I wonder if, you know, we come here every Sunday and many of us are involved in our home groups and there's Bible studies that go on there. And I wonder if we've gotten to that place where we've just allowed ourselves over the course of months and years just to sit back and listen, and maybe something is said by somebody that, oh, I feel a certain sense of excitement about that for a few days or something like that. Otherwise, it's more like, how did I feel about that? Well, it was a little too long tonight and maybe a little too complicated. I'm going to give that a 4, you know, this type of thing. And I think a lot of us are exactly like that. And we take in and we take in and we take in, and we live in a content-rich community, and we've become truth snobs. The cafeteria is so rich, it's like, I'll take a little of this, a little of that, a little of the other thing. But what we're not doing is we're not leaving a session discussing the Word of God in the presence of the Holy Spirit, who seeks to apply these things to our life, asking ourselves, Lord, what thing, maybe just one thing, what is there in this thing that we're studying from your word, one thing that you are calling on me to, in a concrete and practical way, apply to my life and live out this week? Something that's going to be on my mind. I'm going to find a way to live this out at work, at home, wherever it might be. And that is the only way for the reality of God to be fresh, and where the hunt for God, the trail remains alive. We've got to act. And the passivity that really has overcome a media-driven culture like our own, where we sit and we take in and we absorb, and we don't ever get to that place of, okay, what do I do now about that? That's a problem. Clarity always comes through action. Always. Always. I have this moment of clarity. That for me, they're not very common. You know, in my marriage, that I finally understand what she's been talking about all these years, you know. That type of thing. Stick that, fold it up and put it in my pocket. Got that. Oh, man, but you forget. It loses its liveliness. It loses its clarity unless you're willing to act, unless you're willing to move toward a person that you've had insight about or whatever. You will absolutely lose the moment. You'll lose the moment. So the woman is a seeker because she's willing to act. She acts on the basis of the things that she knows. Here's a second point of contrast. these religious folk, you know, they knew a lot and they had their position. And the reality is that these were very arrogant men who had significant bottom line demands. Namely, I will seek God just so long as he's the God that I want him to be. As long as he's the God that I want him to be, I will seek him. And so they create this whole religious system around what they want their God to be, and of course their elevated status within that framework. And so Jesus says to them in Mark 12, verses 38 to 40, beware of the scribes. They like the respectful greetings, the chief seats at the synagogues and places of honor, and they offer their long prayers for appearance sake. And just that, you know, a seeker is not a person who establishes what the outcome is going to be. And that's what these guys were about. And Jesus didn't fit their mold, and so he was to be rejected. And there is a real danger in a kind of seeking that we have, at the end of the day, has to serve the demands of my ego. It has to leave me in this intact place that he's describing here of the scribes. And in contrast to that sort of arrogance, that sort of sanctification of the status quo, this woman who comes to the temple with her little lepti, less than a cent in value, each one, is really a picture of humility and of public exposure. I mean, think about it. Jesus is sitting there with his disciples. They're watching people enter this area of the temple where the collection box is, and they're able to observe exactly what everyone's putting in. So if I've got a lot of money to put in, you know, I'm doing this because everyone will know. Oh, that guy, he's generous. But if I've got nothing, and literally less than a cent to rub together in my hand, like this widow, and I'm going to risk going out in public, I'm going to risk seeking after God in a place that really is relatively humiliating to me, because I'm just putting in basically nothing. And I think here again, this is a very important facet of what does it mean to be a true seeker after God. Jesus was deeply impressed by this woman. He was impressed because he said that she gave far more than anyone there because of the relative value of that gift to her, as opposed to their giving out of their abundance. And that humility, that just to risk being out there as a widow, as destitute, of being on a very hierarchical culture. You know, people looked at you and said, how do you fit into the cultural hierarchy, and therefore how should I treat you? And if you're below me, I treat you like crap, and if you're above me, with deference, right? Well, you got the lepers down here, and then just above that are destitute widows. And so she's very far down the food chain. And yet she's willing to come out and seek God in a place where she would be exposed in that way. And that's important. That to seek God and to really say, Lord God, I want to discover you in the breadth of my life. I want to know, what does it mean for me to find you in my marriage and in my family? I want to know, what does it mean for me to find you at my place of work, in my neighborhood, and whatever it is? Well, you know, there's a certain vulnerability that we are really kind of putting out there. The risk of being embarrassed, the risk of doing it badly, the temptation to compare. This woman, on no doubt, she goes down to the temple and she knows nobody gives as little as I do. No one's got as little to give as me. And yet, she stays in the fight. She continues to go. She's invested. And she's okay with that. I think sometimes we stop seeking because we compare ourselves to others. And we say, well, see, that person, you know, if I knew what that person knew, well, yeah, then I would pursue the things of God. But the reality is, I'm never going to get there, so forget it. I'll just pursue my own thing, which is namely the thing that I'm good at and feel good about, and leave the whole God thing to somebody else. And so there is that tension, I think, often within many of us as kind of upper middle class and educated and career oriented. We lean into the area where we're strong, where we know we don't have 2 cents to rub together. Out of embarrassment or whatever, we just don't go there anymore. We don't seek, and so we don't find. What has God given you? What has God given you to give back to Him, to invest in the things that He is about? Because it is when you take action and when you are prepared with humility to present whatever that is to Him that He becomes alive to you in your experience. What has God given to you? Hey, probably a whole lot more than what you think. And, you know, I think it's when we kind of are willing to size ourselves up. This is a very talented crowd here on Sunday night. We've got brilliantly, intellectually gifted people. We've got doers that can really get things done. We've got amazingly charismatic personalities. We've got all kind of folk here, and that would include all of you. And you will find God as you seek Him by investing whatever it is that He's given to you for Him. Well, I'm just kind of waiting to hear from God. What do you want from me, God? And I haven't heard anything, so I guess the answer is nothing. Now, that's a very arrogant position to take, as though somehow God is just going to sit back there in His eternity, just waiting for that moment to disclose His purpose for your life. What has God given you? Take stock of that and mobilize that, like this woman did, for the things of God. And then you will begin to understand what God is really all about. You will discover Him. And I think that's an awesome sort of point. Last point, most important one in terms of contrast. For these religious folks, those questions that they asked Jesus, there was really nothing at stake. They were content with the status quo. They really did not want things to change. And so their questions were really just there, again, as a test, to trip Him up, to find occasion to dismiss Him. And for them, the real problems, those are out there someplace. We don't have problems. We don't need the Messiah's solution, or not the Messiah, at least, that Jesus proclaimed to be. The problems I have are very external indeed. And so as a result, I'm not really going to seek, because I don't see any need for any change. I'm pretty personally vested in my unbelief. I mean, what would the neighbors think if they heard that I was like into God? Or my colleague? Or whatever. And, you know, just like the religious elite of Jesus' day, there's sort of a culture of unbelief in our society as well. You know, to stand up and say, I'm a Christian, for most people, that there's a negativity, there's a fear, there's a sense that this is just, wow, you know, really? Has it come to that? I'm so sorry for you. You know, are you that desperate? And people in our culture, they just don't want to go there at all. It's like going to AA or something. I got this problem. Because I'm really okay. Really, I am. I'm telling myself, I'm convincing myself, I'm really okay. You know, which is such crap, such BS. The reality is that outside of a confidence in a relationship with God, we're on our own. And we bear the weight of what is my life about, what matters. I got questions that absolutely cannot be answered. That's a very burdensome place to be, and it's an unnecessary place to be, and we're only at that place because we're stuck in our own pride. We are not willing to just come before God to say, I'm really not okay. I do realize that while I may be comfortable, I don't have answers to the only really important questions that matter at all. And whereas this woman, look, for her, everything was at stake in her pursuing God. She was willing to risk everything that she had. Think about it. A destitute person. And yet she's willing to literally put her money where her mouth is. Years ago, I was a caddy. And when I was in seventh grade, I guess, 1969, the NCAA held their annual tournament at Ohio State. I got out of school to caddy in the tournament. I was really thrilled about that. And I got this golfer from Stanford. And it wasn't Tiger Woods. He wasn't born yet. But this guy was very impressive to me, and he was really tall, and he just wowed me. I thought, oh. And we're talking at the ninth hole break about, you know, how's your guy doing and this and that. And I'm like, I know my guy's going to win this tournament. And some of the older caddies were like, okay, Leffel, put your money where your mouth is. And I realized I didn't really believe it that much after all, you know? This woman, she put her money where her mouth is. She was all in. That's what seekers do. This is not an ivory tower intellectual exercise. Everything's at stake. Look, if there is a God, and if that God has entered history through Jesus Christ, and he is offering us the ability to become reconciled to him through the death of Christ on the cross, what more important thing could there be than that? Than that? Reconciled to God, inheritor of eternal life, living in the presence under the power and the influence of God's Spirit. Well, that everything's at stake here. Every other consideration we have, it just pales in comparison to the importance of that claim. And this woman pursued God with her limited knowledge, with everything she had. Wow. That's very embarrassing to me. I don't know about you. Look, her security, her future, her present needs, everything was on the line, Jesus says, because she was willing to give whatever she had. She was willing to trust God with her life and give over to him everything. That's a seeker. And it raises this question, I think. Are we willing to trust God with our lives? Or do we live in fear? Are we prepared to say, God, all that I am, my future, my security, my needs, I want to just trust you with those things. I'm willing to move in areas that put those things at risk so that I can find you in my life. Or are we basically saying, you know, I'm really happy with my life the way it is. I do have this kind of, I don't know, ambiguous guilt thing going with God, so I'll pay him off now and then with a gift. And, you know, that's what the Pharisees were doing. That's what the scribes were doing. That's not authentic seeking. That's blackmail. And this woman is basically prepared to say, look,
if these things are true, if you are the God of Israel, if there is a way to be reconciled with you, which is what the temple is all about, man, count me in. Count me all the way in. I want that. I want that. That's more important than whether or not I'll be able to use these two lepti to buy a piece of bread this afternoon. What will you put on the line to seek God? That's my question to you here tonight. What will you put on the line to seek God in your life? Because He is going to call you to places where you will have to put things on the line to seek Him. It's inevitable. It's going to happen. And let me just illustrate that a couple of ways. Harmony in relationship. Will I sacrifice present harmony for the positive good of another person in relationship with them, so that I can find God's purpose in that relationship? My daughter, our daughter, this week turned 16. She had a 16th birthday party. She had many friends over to our house. We cooked a big spread. They're all out in the backyard. We're hiding in the front. Way after everyone else shows up, this car drives, creeping up to our house, and it's and the windows are vibrating and all this kind of stuff, and it just sits there for 15 minutes, and four of us were out on the front porch. We're like, you know, is this thing going to blow up or what? You know, it was a little frightening. And then out pops this guy. Is this the Lethal's house? Yeah, out back. I know this guy, and he's complicated. And I know my daughter, and she's sweet and sensitive and deep. And you know what happens in teenage years with sweet and sensitive and deep girls with really complicated guys? They find a way, right? And so the next day, this guy calls her up. No surprise there. And so Ames, our daughter, calls me up at work. Hey, no one's here. Can he whose name shall not be mentioned come over? Okay, now I got a choice to make right here. Will I choose the answer that she wants to hear that will preserve harmony? Or will I offer the more complicated answer, the one that she does not want to hear, which is, sweetie, Mom will be home in a couple hours, then it would be appropriate to invite this guy over. How do you feel about that? I asked. Well, she says, you know what she said. So it sounds like you don't trust me, Dad. Well, sweetie, we'll talk about that later. It's a gray area, but I feel like I know my daughter. I have my dad-dar up on this guy, and I'm thinking God's purposes for this whole situation is going to be better served without the two of them in my house alone, okay? But for a couple of days, what did I get? Ames, can we talk about that phone call? I told you when I got home from work, we ought to sit down and talk about that. I don't want to talk about it. Whatever. You know, this kind of thing. It would have been so easy just to say, look, it's way too much hassle. I can't stand the thought of my precious little daughter giving me the cold shoulder, the cold treatment, all that kind of stuff. So just, I trust you, do whatever. Which would not have been love for either one of those kids. That would have been the wrong thing to do. But to follow, to find God, to seek God,
in that relationship means that I'm willing to risk harmony for the good of that relationship. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is costly. It's difficult. We put our security, our future, our needs on the line for the sake of following God into these areas of our life. Certainly in context of this passage, that we are we willing to risk our way of living for our ability to participate in what God's doing in the Christian community of which we're a part and his work in the world? You know, some of us are like, well, you know, I've got my life all set up, and if I can squeeze God like mortar between bricks into the cracks, then okay. But see, then we'll never get to the sweet thing with God, because we've just drawn our lines and we say, here's where you fit. Here's where you fit. Here's where you belong, God. God is not mortar. And if we are going to seek him, we seek him on his terms, which is like this woman, that we present our whole selves to him. And we are open, genuinely open, to be led with whatever resources we have so that we have the joy and the privilege of participating in the things of God. And that means hard choices about the limits that we're willing to put on career, the amount of time that we're willing to indulge our habits or chasing our kids from one soccer game to another or whatever it is, just to be able to say, does my life make sense in the light of what I say that I believe? Do I put my money where my mouth is? There's awkwardness in sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ. There's no doubt about that. Will we risk that awkwardness, risk maybe being misperceived by someone just for the sake of getting the only real news that matters out on the table before people? And I think that we find ourselves seizing up at that place. We don't want to lose face. We don't want to appear to fit into a negative grid that maybe somebody may have of what it means to be a Christian. And so we back off. To follow Christ, to seek God, is to move into those awkward places, trusting in him and ultimately finding that they're way less awkward than we usually think that they are. And then here would be another example of whether or not I'm going to live within the limitations of my own personality, my own experience, my own character, and lob love bombs over the wall, hoping that they somehow hit somebody out there whose silhouette I can kind of see through the mist. In other words, to protect myself. Don't want to be imposed upon, don't want people to get too close, right? You know, we can live that way. That's what our culture is all about, this radical individualism. We all do our own thing. We protect self. And then we are slaves to self. And then the life of the self is choked out of us by the self. And we're really miserable. And there's a better way, which is, well, are we willing to say, okay, I've got all kinds of inhibitions, all kinds of fears and whatever else, but God says in this passage, love God with your whole being and your neighbor as yourself. And what that means is that I've got to put the real interests of other people ahead of my own feelings, and that's going to require that I really trust God that he will be at work, that he will make this vulnerable moment actually effective in the life of a person who I care about, and will use that to transform my life, and I will find him there. I will find the place to trust him. I will see his work transforming my life at that place. That's beautiful. That's awesome. So, the contours of a true seeker. The question I want to leave us with, will you seek God? Will you seek God here tonight? And maybe, again, you've been a Christian for a long time, but not maybe for a while, seeking in the terms that we've described from this passage here tonight. Seeking with real humility, seeking
in action and not just between our ears, seeking where there's real risk involved. Will you seek God here tonight? See, Jesus promises, he says, you seek and you will find. If you seek, you will find me. Knock and the door will be opened to you. That's a promise from God. If you seek me with all your heart, you will find me. Beautiful. And there's another promise too, which is that God is seeking you. God is seeking you. God has brought you here this evening to consider these truths from his word, because he loves you, because he's pursuing you, because he wants to bless your life, because he wants to be alive to you, because he wants you to be found, and he has been pursuing you, and he's got people in your life, and he's got the whole thing that has brought you to this place. We're here tonight, we realize, yes, it's not just that I'm seeking God. God also is seeking me. God loves me far more even than I would be able to love myself. Jesus puts it like this in Revelation. He says, behold, I stand at the door of your life and knock. And if anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I'll come in. But I'm on the initiative. I'm knocking at your door. I'm saying I'm there. I'm saying I'm seeking you. I have an offer on the table. You can be reconciled to me. Not by being a good person, not by doing the right thing, but simply by opening the door of your heart to my forgiveness, to my mercy. That is the gospel. It's not religion. It's a gift. And God is saying, I have this for you. And will you receive it? Will you take it?
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.